I am Plante on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. One of the more insightful, witty, and necessary books is F-Bomb, Dispatches from the War on Feminism, in a time where women are abandoning feminism and the onslaught against women due to anti-feminist PR campaigns, politicians of Donald Trump's ilk, Gamergate, and more. The author, Loren McKeon, goes to the front line and reveals some of the challenges head-on. She explores the anti-feminist universe, talking to some of its proponents and activists. The book looks at how race, class, and gender affects feminism, and just how much more inclusive it could be. Loren McKeon is an award-winning editor and writer. She is digital editor at The Walrus and former editor of this magazine and a contributing editor at Toronto Life. This new book is published by Goose Lane. Please welcome to the Plante on the Line program, Loren McKeon. Ms. McKeon, good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. There's just so much in this book that I want to talk about that I've had to sort of, just looking at my notes here, I just want to ration myself because I have just a little bit of time with you this mm-hmm. morning. Let's start with anti-feminism and the rise of that in our society today. Men are largely responsible for that, but also women, and
yes.
You set out to understand them.
Yes, I certainly, it is men and women, and a lot of what F-Bomb looks at is how women are actually starting to lead the backlash against feminism right now. And I think, you know, we see, we've kind of seen this cyclical history of backlash against feminism. We've seen it in the 80s, you know, we've seen it before. Anytime women seem to be getting ahead or, you know, achieving something that looks closer to equality on paper and in society, we do start to see the backlash. And what's particularly haunting, I guess, right now and concerning is that a lot of the backlash right now is being led by women who do believe that feminism has gone too far and it's pushing women too far, and in fact it's not helping women at all anymore.
So when, let's say you just think of that at face value. One would, if they were conspiratorial, say, assume that men have co-opted these women to say those things. I mean, is that your experience, or do these women actually believe that?
Yeah, like, they do believe it, of course, 100%. And I think, you know, as much as I politically don't agree with them on many, many issues, it does do them a disservice to say, you know, that they're just, you know, their puppet.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, because they do also have a very unique idea of why they don't think feminism is working for women. They think that it promotes a culture of victimhood. They think that it does a disservice to mothers. They don't believe rape culture exists. So they don't like, you know, the current feminist agenda that's really pushing back against rape culture. And they also kind of idealize the traditional roles and values that we're seeing spread elsewhere too in other movements, where we want this return to this false idea of where the way we think things used to be, simpler times.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, all of those are very women perspectives, and it's a very female response to what they perceive as wrong with feminism. Whereas, you know, when you talk to men in the movement, in some cases, their points intercede and they have some of the same points and they don't like some of the same things. But in a lot of cases, they're coming at it from very different angles, although often with the same result of undermining feminism's victories.
So is the word feminism wrong? Because if you talk to some of these women, they use the word themselves. They describe themselves as feminists. So right away, there's a conflict as to what the word means, probably even within the feminist movement itself.
Yeah, well, I think right now, you know, there is no one capital F feminism, and that's a good thing, because far be it for me or anyone else, I think, to really define feminism for every person. And I think, you know, what the feminist movement itself is doing right now is going through some growing pains, but also going through a process of self-interrogation and really figuring out where it needs to expand and where it needs to grow. And, you know, where it needs to have a discussion about how it can reach more people and bring more people into the movement, especially women who have felt that the movement hasn't been for them or isn't for them. The challenge is that while that's happening, the anti-feminist movement is defining what feminism is, and really undermining the definition of what feminism means. But we've left ourselves open for that to happen.
Yeah, and so, I mean, the discussion from within, you know, also signals to say, you know, its future as well, right? I mean, it could, I mean, that's one of the things that you write about in the book, that it's one of the challenges to feminism, this internal debate.
There's an ambulance going by the office, but you said, you know, part of the challenge is that, you know, there's that ongoing debate within feminism as well.
Yeah, and do you think that is a detriment to feminism survival?
I think that it has allowed the anti-feminist movement to sort of swoop in and look at any weaknesses and kind of exploit them. But at the same time, there's good discussion and there's discussion that isn't fruitful. So I think, you know, the discussion that isn't fruitful is when women attack themselves, when they blame themselves, sort of this, you know, public calling out that we're seeing where it's not really coming from maybe a very traditional feminist perspective of raising other people up or raising other women up. At the same time, we definitely shouldn't shy away from discussion in the feminist movement. I don't think we should expect that everyone would adhere to it, because when we do stuff like that, we're speaking to quiet voices that already don't have enough of a platform, and we're doing a disservice to the feminist movement if we don't have a discussion. So we're in a very difficult time right now where we want lots of fruitful discussion, positive discussion, good discussion that will help us grow. At the same time, there's other stuff happening that's undermining it.
Yeah, and the marginalized voices that haven't been participating in the debate thus far, people of an ethnic background, say, or even younger women, younger feminists, how do you invite their voices into participating as to what feminism ought to be?
Yeah, and that's like it's a difficult question, and it's something that I also confront in the book, because certainly in the book, you know, I have to, it would be dishonest if I didn't also grapple with the fact that although I'm a young woman, I'm also a white woman, I'm a straight woman, and, you know, I am of the segment that typically is given a platform, and here I am on a platform. So, you know, and I've certainly been asked that question in other interviews. And I think women that are in that position of privilege really have to be honest with themselves about what that means. And, you know, we have to ask ourselves, we have to kind of confront the fear. I think there's a fear that if we cede some of the platform, then it means we won't have a voice. But what it actually means is if you cede some of the platform, you're making room for more voices, which will strengthen goals and perspectives. So it can be as simple and as practical as making sure if you're invited on a panel that the panel isn't all white women of a certain age.
Mm-hmm.
It can be, you know, as much if you work in media like I do, making sure that you're very intentional about assigning stories to women of color, LGBTQ populations, indigenous women, women with disabilities, you know, looking at what voices you don't have and aren't there and actively seeking them out and extending that hand so that they know that their voices are valued and that you want to help them be heard.
I guess this is the problem through various institutions, not just in feminism, that there's a generational and, say, class divide that I guess we need to get over, and that just simply means that there's a certain generation, sort of people in the boomer class, say, or the people in middle age that are entrenched, their ideas are entrenched because they're in charge.
Yeah, and I think, you know, a lot of what's happening, there is that generational divide. There's a lot of different segments right now in feminism that maybe they don't all prioritize the same issue. And I do think that you know, we can work together as a plurality of feminisms working together for one goal. But certainly in the generational side, you know, there's this sense from older generations that younger feminists don't give credit where credit is due. And maybe they don't realize how far they've come because of, you know, these women that have really put themselves out there and fought at the beginning. But that there's also a sense from younger feminists that older feminists might not be as open-minded to look at some of the issues that are really important to younger feminists now, so issues of sex work, transgender rights, indigenous rights, opening it up to really look at what diversity means. And I think that's where we're seeing some of the conflict.
So then do you think it gets better once that generation has moved on, say, and say people of our vintage are say, their age?
I don't think it's a matter of the older generation moving on and we just kind of have to age them out. I think that, you know, it does do an incredible disservice to the work that they've done before. I think that part of the challenge right now is that not a lot of these different segments or populations or generations are really talking to each other. And I think that's where we can have more fruitful change, is where, you know, younger generations can learn from older generations, tactics of the movement, you know, where they felt they didn't go far enough. And then older generations can learn, you know, why a lot of younger generations are really prioritizing diversity and why it's so important to include more voices. And I think, you know, we'll be stronger together rather than waiting for one, you know, one set of thinking to move on. I don't know if that will get us very far.
I would think that the most possible thing that will happen is that we just turn into those people, right?
Yeah, it's kind of, it's been interesting. Some of the most interesting feedback I've gotten in the book, from the book, even though it's only been out for a month, is from older women, especially, who have read it and said, you know, I didn't know that X issue was existed.
Yeah.
I didn't know that my thinking was as narrow-minded, you know, as I've now come to realize that it is. You know, I hadn't been thinking about these issues, and I didn't realize that I needed to. And also from older women who said, you know, I thought everything was fine now. Like, I didn't realize that it wasn't, because they're not moving and living and growing up in the same climate as young women are now, and young women and men.
The thing that I got out of this book as I'm reading it, and the various experiences that you talk about that you've had, and the research that you present in the book, is just how much better things would be if we just talked amongst ourselves and talked to one another, whether it's an older generation or, say, as you do in the book, you talk to those who hate feminism. Is it really necessary to talk to them? And what do you say to people who ask that question?
Yeah, I've been asked that question a lot. And, you know, I'm not naive enough to think that, you know, we could talk someone out of truly hateful views. But what I do think is that if we shy away from examining those views, if we just try to ignore them or dismiss them, then we run the danger of not knowing how to confront them and of thinking that they don't exist when we've clearly seen that they do. And we, you know, we saw this in the state where people didn't believe that Donald Trump was going to win the nomination. You know, he was kind of treated as a joke at first. And then when he got the nomination and later when he won the presidency, people wanted to know what happened. They didn't understand who could possibly have voted for him, or they didn't even understand why more than 50% of white women voted for him. So, you know, we run the risk of not understanding what's happening or underestimating this rising backlash when we ignore it. And I think that will hurt us in the long run. So I think we have to be careful about how we give these views platforms as journalists, but that to ignore it is even a more dangerous tactic.
So there's an episode in the book where you go to one woman's house, mm-hmm. and you make a meal together, and you discuss her opposing view. You said a moment ago you don't go in there to, I don't know. Do you go in there to try to convince her?
No.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, she probably wanted to convince me. Mm-hmm. But I think, no, I don't go in there to convince her, because I think that as a journalist, and my goal with talking to women who were anti-feminist, or even just maybe didn't understand what it meant, or, thought it wasn't for them, or it was a done movement. In all of these cases, my goal wasn't necessarily to convert them, because I think that's a very dangerous ethical line to tread as a journalist,
yeah.
Even as a feminist. I tried to go in as a journalist first and ask informed questions and really try and get a handle on not only what these beliefs were, but how they were connecting to other women and how they were gaining traction and why they were gaining traction. And I think, the only way we can do that is to talk to people that maybe we don't agree with. But if we sit there and go in with an agenda to argue with them or to convince them, I'm not sure that we'll really learn anything.
So at the end of that particular experience, do you think either of you understood the other person better?
Yeah, I think that, I think what's interesting is when you meet someone in person and you have a conversation with them and you spend time with them, you realize that they're human, and it's not, boiled down to soap boxes anymore, or people warring on Twitter. So you can understand the human motivations for what makes them believe what they believe, and you realize there's some things that you might like about them, even though you might find other things totally abhorrent.
Yeah.
So I think, and that's, in a way, I think that's even scarier, because it's really easy to dismiss, a troll living in his basement as a troll living in, their mother's basement or whatever, the kind of image that we have of the alt-right or anti-feminist. It's much harder to grapple with the idea that these people have families and communities and other people that they influence, and people who may not be as extreme as they are, but will agree with some of their ideas and go forth and spread those ideas to other people that are that may seem very moderate, very normal, very mainstream. And I think that's what we have to confront and what we really have to look at.
You write in the book about your own experience, your own rape, and what it was like for you to be voiceless. And we've seen in recent weeks, the hashtag MeToo and what that's unleashed in terms of women talking about what's happened to them. Do you think something has changed in light of say, the Weinstein matter? And, this week we're talking about Bill O'Reilly. When something like that happens in the news, there's obviously something that happens immediately in the culture, online, on Facebook, on Twitter. Does that have an effect, say, long term, where feminism is trending towards?
I think that movements like Me Too are powerful. I mean, we've seen so many women rise up and share their stories, and many women that haven't ever told anyone before. And we've also seen it dominate media conversation, which is very encouraging. That, it's still surprising that so many people are surprised that this affects so many women. And I think that what's important now is that we have to take the conversation that's happening and keep it going. And that, before we congratulate ourselves too much, we should also remember that we've kind of been here before. Mm. Whenever powerful men get in trouble, we do talk about it. We do rise up. It does dominate media. And, we've had hashtags before like hashtag been raped, never reported, that came after Gomeshi. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had the same conversation then. Is it finally going to change things? Is this going to be what we need to, you know, push it into awareness? And then we're having those same conversations now with Me Too. And that doesn't diminish the power and of survivors speaking up and sharing their story. But I think what's important now is that we have to figure out somehow, and I don't know the answer for this because it's such a big question, but somehow figure out how to keep the conversation going so that we're not in the same spot 6 months from now saying, maybe we finally solved it with this hashtag. People are talking out. People are paying attention. You know, how do we make sure that we don't turn away from it again?
Yeah. This is such a powerful book because it has so much in here that's timely and that's important. But when you look at where we're headed, are you hopeful at all when you look at trends and the strain of anti-feminism? How do you see where it ends up?
You know, I've been asked this question a lot, and I think, you know, very intentionally when I was looking at the book, just in terms of like how I was going to structure it and who I was going to talk to and what I wanted to cover, I didn't want it to be like all sad, sad, depressing, like very sad. Uh-huh. Like, and I think, you know, the first two parts of the book are meant to be alarming, are meant to show the scope, are meant to wake people up to what's going on. But I do think that there is a lot to be hopeful about and a lot to be optimistic about. And that was the goal, the third part of the book. And not to say, but everything's going to be okay now, don't worry. But I think that there is so much that's going on that's encouraging with younger generations who are taking feminism and reviving it and expanding that conversation and understand that it has to be a conversation, that we have to open it up, that we have to look at who feminism is, has maybe kept out or who has felt left out from the movement. And I think that the feminism they're building for the future will be something, you know, that I could never have even imagined when I was a teenager, but that it will be something that can give us hope and that it will go forward and it will be a better feminism for the future and it will propel the conversation. I don't know if this conversation will ever be done. You know, I'd like to say the next generation will solve feminism and then we'll have equality and then everything will be great. But it's so pervasive and we have so much to undo and confront. But I think what's important is that we don't give up.
Indeed, yeah. You know, I guess you grew up in a time where a lot of people thought that it was over, that it was done. And when this complacency sets in, people overlook the fact that it is not done.
Yeah, I think my generation, so I'm 33, when I started writing the book, I was still in my late 20s, or when I started researching it. And I do think, you know, my generation, and even women that I spoke to that were in my generation for the book, they really were a lot of them of the, you know, they really did think that, the, you know, that they had made it, that we had arrived. And I think that that's only true for some privileged sections of my generation where, you know, other people have still been living this disparity as part of their regular lives. And when I talk about, you know, Me Too, I'm surprised that it's still surprising to people. I think, you know, there's a lot of people that would say, I'm surprised that you're still surprised that there's a backlash against feminism or that, you know, we've been kept out of the movement. So it's important to step outside of our own bubbles and really look at not just how women we know are doing, but how women are doing in general.
Yeah, as a guy who's 35, I didn't think about these things because I thought it was inevitable and I thought that it was done. It was a done deal.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it takes a book like yours to make one realize just how unfinished it all is and how tenuous it all is.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's exhausting. That's a really exhausting thought as a feminist. But it's also, I think, a necessary thought right now, that we really rejuvenate and think about what we can do beyond, you know, putting on a feminist t-shirt or carrying like a cool feminist tote bag,
yeah.
How we can live it and lift up people around us.
Yeah, you mentioned a moment ago you started the book, and I guess I read this in 2014. The world is a very different place today than it was then. Did you think it would get as bad as it has?
It's interesting. You know, certainly in 2014, when I was really looking intensely at these trends, I did hear a lot of people who would say to me, like, what are you talking about? Like, there's no anti-feminist movement that's happening. You know, if they do, they'll never gain traction. Like, feminism is done. Like, it's good for, you know, we're in this happy place right now as women, and equality is assured for us.
Uh-huh.
And that surprised me then, but it also meant that, you know, as we were starting to see the backlash against, you know, reproductive rights, as we were starting to see the backlash against activists who worked to combat rape culture on campus, it didn't surprise me as much because I had been steeped in these worlds and investigating them and talking to people and looking at these trends, you know, as we saw, say, Donald Trump start to rise. You know, as we saw even, you know, in Canada, Andrew Scheer start to rise. You know, as we started to see this pushback and this bubbling against progressive values in both Canada and the U.S., I know on the election night in the U.S., I was like, oh, I was right. It was just kind of like, this is a thing I never wanted to be right about. But I remember watching it, and, like, that's what I was thinking, and, you know, talking to people after in the States who have been doing similar research into the rising of you know, traditional values and how this was also happening. Who said the same thing? Who said, I've been researching this for the past year or 2 years, and I kept telling people we should pay attention, but no one wanted to listen, and now they're all wondering what happened.
Lorraine, I really appreciate your time today. This is such a necessary book and an important one. I really hope more people read this. Congratulations on the book and continued good luck with it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
The book is called F-Bomb Dispatches from the War on Feminism. It's published by Goose Lane. Its author, Lorraine McKeon. Join me on the line from Toronto in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.